This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Gaze podcast. You can hear us live on Joy 94.9 Saturday afternoon from noon via the live stream at joy.org.au/listen live. Or tune your wireless in Melbourne to 94.9 FM.
One, two, three, four.
Use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, nail it, grade it, try to point it to me, press it, snap it, work it, quick, erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quickly write it, plug it, play it.
This is Joy 94.9, and you're listening to Technogaze, where we gaze into the world of consumer electronics, gadgets, and technology. And I should wear on my glasses.
You should. Is that why you're squinting and trying to figure out what you're saying?
Yes, that's the one.
Put your glasses on, Michael.
Oh, okay. Actually, no one can see me, so that's fine.
That's right.
There goes modesty.
They're lovely.
And we can hear the voice of Donna.
Hello. Hi,
Donna. And Raina.
How there?
Welcome. So today's show, we're going to kick off with a roundup of the latest news in tech, including the PS4 Blue Light of Death.
Ooh.
Da-da. Security, or lack thereof, with free Wi-Fi. How Google software is outsmarting its creators. And, of course, more smartwatch news, because it's going to be the thing of the future.
So we hear.
And Google does evil.
Again, still.
A bit later on, we're going to be looking at some interesting uses of technology in medical applications, and we're all going to find out about gamification from a local pioneer here from Melbourne. And it's probably not what most of you think it is.
What do you think it is?
Oh, we'll wait and see. And we have a personal record that we need to set today. We don't want to use the A word.
The A word.
Don't say it.
Apple. I'm not saying it.
Oh, sorry.
Michael. Good job.
So much for subtlety. So what do we start off with?
Winamp.
Winamp.
What is Winamp?
Winamp used to be, well, still is, but not for much longer, a MP3 player. And it's been around for some time, quite a long time. It was one of the earliest ones, I think, that I remember ever using when MP3s became a thing. And apparently it was still kicking around in this post-iTunes world.
1997, and AOL have announced that it's going to be shut down and closed on the 20th of December this year. So it's been around a long time, and for many people it was the thing that changed everything for them for music. So MP3s had been around for a while then, but it was really torturous trying to rip your CDs and organise them and figure out what was going on, and Winamp really changed that for the legions of people using Windows in the late 90s. It really kind of brought it, it effectively brought it mainstream and out of the pure geek realm.
And it was freeware?
It was shareware. And interestingly,
remember shareware.
And one of the other articles, I was reading some sort of retrospectives about this, because I do get kind of nostalgic when you hear about these deaths of digital kind of things. It was sort of talking about the fact that, you know, it was shareware, but it was completely uncrippled, because we also talk about crippleware, that, you know, you can get a free version, but you've got to pay to unlock the features, and you get that a lot in apps these days. But back then, shareware was the software just worked, and if you liked it, you paid the money. And, you know, I found this little sort of snippet of the dude who ran it was sort of saying, you know, nothing was ever broken if you didn't pay. There was no feature that was unlocked. In the year before we were acquired, we were bringing in $100,000 a month from $10 checks. That's paper checks in the mail.
Wow.
That's huge.
Yeah.
It's, you don't see that a lot these days.
You don't?
Yeah.
Well, certainly not even checks now. But,
well, not checks.
But aside from that, so AOL bought them up in June 1999.
Yep.
And
part of the big dot-com boom for gazillions of dollars. Well, hang on.
$80 million actual dollars. And that they've been hanging on to it all this time. And apparently what they've been trying to do is sell the damn thing for months and months and months, according to some reports. So Ars Technica has a great article about it. And apparently they've been trying to sort of quietly get rid of it in a profit-making sort of way, and no one wants it.
What I found kind of bizarre is that they've released Android and Mac versions as recently as a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Which is kind of bizarre.
Particularly for the Mac. Pretty much dominated
Now.
Yeah,
like use Winamp instead of iTunes. But someone goes on to make the point that it's actually like, you know, a few meg as opposed to 100 meg in terms of the actual size and footprint.
So it's really efficient.
Yeah.
Quick to download. Does AOL ever succeed in anything that it buys? Or is it one of these companies that, you know, buys stuff because it looks good and then it just lingers and dies?
Well, I assume it made them some amount of money afterwards. They had some years to do something good with it.
To be honest, I'm amazed AOL itself still exists.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean,
remember the CDs, the discs on everything?
I don't. I never ever received an AOL disc.
No,
not once.
Oh my goodness! They were littering. I used them as like coffee coasters for many.
Yes, with the software. God, yeah. Those were the good old days. Software distribution by media. Media.
Yes.
We are old people, I think, Michael. Raina's a young whippersnapper and she doesn't remember these olden days.
Oh, no, well, no.
I'm not as old as some, but I do remember at uni we had to use punch cards. not tape, just punch cards. So that was good.
I'm from Tasmania. We didn't have.
Oh, maybe
you know,
that's it. I'm sorry.
They didn't care about us.
We should move on before I make a Tasmanian joke.
Very funny.
Wi-Fi. Free Wi-Fi is good, isn't it?
Well, I think this is really interesting. With the rise of the smartphone and the terrible cost of overseas roaming, if you do happen to travel, then the free Wi-Fi is an absolute kind of lifesaver in many cases. You know, how many of us have become so reliant on, you know, just whipping out the smartphone, looking up the map and figuring out where you are, rather than doing that sort of, you know, deep planning that you used to have to do beforehand. Yeah. And then you get there and you've got no data and you're stuck. So free Wi-Fi is kind of like, you know, well, it's kind of like breathing or water.
Yeah, or a conveniently placed bathroom. You know, it's nice. It's so nice when it's there and you kind of expect it now.
Yeah, but
it has some security holes.
And in fact, this is worthwhile talking about because I think a lot of us are going to be thinking about going on holiday over the Christmas New Year period. Tis the season to jump on planes and go places.
And most of us at home with our Wi-Fi access points have configured a password.
Yeah, we hope. And if you haven't, please do.
Yeah, please do. But with free Wi-Fi, very often they don't. Mm. And so, people think this is good because it's very convenient, I can get onto it. But the problem with that is that anybody else on that network can actually see all of the traffic that's going up and down the network.
And so few people actually use encrypted connections that, you know, we actually put an enormous amount of data in plain text and passwords, all that sort of stuff, going kind of free and easy over open Wi-Fi. And this is not good TM.
But the thing is, even if you're using an encrypted connection, so if you're using HTTPS, and you can see the little padlock in there, that somebody on the same network can essentially copy all of the traffic and pretend to be that HTTPS provider. So your PC thinks, oh, yes, I've got a proper connection, and then it passes it on to whoever you're trying to get access to, and they can snoop. Now, it takes a bit of work to do it, but technically it's possible.
Sneaky geeks will find a way.
The other thing that comes out of a lot of discussion about this, so there's a bit of a study that's been done by a large VPN provider, so I'll just put that caveat out there for the time being. But they're saying, well, what are you worried about when you're using public Wi-Fi? And people are going, oh, well, yeah, you know, like my banking and my credit card and my money and stuff like that. But what a lot of security experts are saying is you probably shouldn't be worried so much about that. You should be more worried about your email, because it's when people get access to your email that they can get access to absolutely everything else about you.
Yep.
Yes, that's true. Because I know, for instance, I use my email a lot to use reminders, to put references to things.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's also where all of your password resets go. So if someone gets access to your email, then, and you know, and they know what services you use, then they can basically, you know, get access and lock you out of everything, your entire online identity. Yeah. There's actually a really famous case of this, of a guy, I think it was last year or the year before, and I think his name was Matt, and he, you know, he was actually a pretty savvy kind of, you know, computer geeky kind of person, and he had total identity theft and couldn't, you know, get into it, and he railed against it. He said, look, my identity and persona online is actually mine, and a lot of other people know it, and yet he still really struggled to regain control over his digital life. So it's a non-trivial thing. I mean, this article, like Raina pointed out, I was a little bit, research according to a VPN provider. I mean, they are the ones
Conducted by a security company as well, but yeah, they certainly put the bill on.
Yeah, you know, I mean, they are the ones to gain from it. But that said, it is still a very real issue and one that we hope you may give thought to.
I guess you need to be careful when you're using free Wi-Fi and just think about it before you, you know, access
it. Stay safe.
Yep,
and maybe think about setting
your protection.
Device. Yeah, maybe think about setting your device to not automatically connect to the nearest free thing.
Mm.
It might seem like a good idea.
That's good advice, yeah. Raina.
Very quickly, PS4, New Light of Death.
So that's been out for about a week, the PS4 now. So we were talking last week about the launch and how exciting it was. Except for, I think, I don't know how many it really is. Sony reckons it's less than 1% of customers are affected by this issue, where you try to start the thing up, there's a little blue light that pulses on and off, and it never stops pulsing and it never starts beyond that. Does this sound familiar, any of you guys who are Xbox 360 owners?
The Xbox, what was it, the red ring of
the
death?
The red ring of death. This is more like the blue strip of death or something, I suppose.
Yes.
Now, the Xbox red ring of death was a really big deal for Microsoft. It cost them a lot of money. It was, I think, at a time estimated to be almost 16% of new machines were doing this thing. Sony reckons it's less than 1% of their many sales. But if you are at all interested, you can jump onto Amazon or probably any other online retailer and check out the reviews, and you'll see quite a lot of cranky people.
Oh, well.
Whoops. Hopefully
it's
you're not affected.
14 minutes past 12. We're here on TechnoGaze at Joy 94.9. I forgot to mention, if you want to contact us, you can SMS on 0427-JOY949. You can phone in on 1300-JOY949 or send an email onair@joy.org.au.
Joy 94.9.
TechnoGaze.
It's 12:15 here on Joy 94.9. This is TechnoGaze. I'm Raina. We've got Michael in the studio, also Donna, and a new guest. We've got the lovely Leni.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks
Hi,
for Leni. Having me.
Hey, Leni.
Now, the reason why we've asked Leni to come in today is because we've been talking a little bit in the last few shows about some things to do with health, etc. And Leni has been fortunate enough to try out a new device that I was hoping maybe you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I hurt my back about 13 months ago.
Yeah.
And I tore a nerve in my spine.
Ooh.
And so I went through a series of processes where they tried to fix the problem, but you can't operate on a torn nerve. So they tried to trick the brain with like a circuit breaker and do a ketamine infusion.
Wow.
Yeah, a difficult experience in a nutshell. And then, so that only partially worked. And so the next process from that is to have a spinal cord stimulator trial. And so they put these wires into your spinal canal and they have electrodes onto the end of the wires.
Mm.
And they sit in the canal and then they're attached to a battery pack and they talk to a remote control via Bluetooth.
Yeah.
And a technician comes into your hospital room every day and creates programs for different parts of your body and literally creates new pathways, neural pathways for your brain to focus on rather than the pain pathway.
Wow, okay. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's really awesome.
Did you, was there a kind of period of like total weirdness where you kind of felt this was strange and cyborgy or stuff, or was it just the process of having, you know, a remedial, like a healthful kind of outcome outweigh that sort of this is techno weirdness sort of, you know, was there any sort of
I didn't have one single moment of oh my god this is weird. The only moments I ever had in the 7-day trial was oh my god, this is sheer relief. I'm gonna have my life back again.
Wow, yeah.
Chronic pain is really hard, isn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah.
How new is this technology? Could you have had this 5 years ago?
Well, apparently they've been doing it for like 30 years in America.
Oh, wow.
In America?
Yeah, because the specialists say go away and do all this research. So I'm a good girl. I've done everything they've said. And so, yeah, 30 years and it's only now starting to come to Australia. And you might have noticed there's been some TV reports and newspaper articles of recently here in Australia, and that's because doctors have gone over and learned how to do it. So now it's available to us.
So why has it taken so long to come to Australia? Do you?
I have no idea. It's probably about the training and the cost of bringing the technology over.
Right. But and so this was a trial. So you.
Yes.
You only got to have a week of this.
Yeah.
And does that mean that you're on some list to get it later? Or?
Yep. So if the trial is successful and two things need to happen in the trial, it needs to reduce pain significantly and it needs to increase function significantly.
Mm.
So you have to be able to do things that you couldn't do previously within that trial period. So you have homework. So I had to go to the movies. I had to push a trolley. I had to sit down for long periods of time. So more than half an hour, 2 hours. Things I couldn't... I can't do those things.
Wow.
So I was able to do all of those things and my pain. So on average, I'm an 8 out of 10 for pain. And with the machine, it went all the way down to 2 and I even rated a 0.
Wow.
So it sends vibrations to where the pain is. So if you're comfortable with a constant vibration instead of the whatever pain you have, so my pain is being squeezed or being stabbed or whatever it is, then you're okay. But some people can't cope with that sensation and then they opt out of it. So you have the trial first and they use less expensive equipment. So each wire costs $700 in the trial, but with the permanent operation, each wire costs $7,000.
Wow.
So the permanent operation is $46,000. Very expensive.
And is that, I mean, in Australia, is that covered for you
on
Medicare?
It is
not. You've got to pay for that out of pocket.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is this sort of surgery, can anyone be a good candidate for that? Or is this very specific sort of cases?
Yeah, it's extreme.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are for extreme cases.
Well, yeah. You'd hope. but is it the sort of thing where maybe certain conditions maybe aren't as good for this? I mean, like if the pain comes from or the broken nerve is from somewhere else? Or
I don't know.
Not sure?
I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I'm only a sufferer.
I was going to ask, with the permanent solution, are you expecting to be better in terms of pain relief or about the same as for the trial?
So they say that it gives you 5 to 6 good days out of the week.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I can do things, like I said, it will decrease the pain and increase the function. So I will be able to go back to full-time function, full-time work, have a social life again, things that have completely been cut out of my life.
That's right. Amazing.
Yeah.
The you know, you said that it's the device is controlled via Bluetooth.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about the security around it?
No. So the tech.
Can we hack into you?
You probably could. The technician would come in. She would connect via Bluetooth to the electrodes,
yes.
And she would create new programs. So we might work on a program for sitting down, and then the next day she'd come in and we'd work on a program for standing up,
right.
Or lying down.
Yeah.
And then so by the end of it, I'd have 5 or 6 different programs, and then I would work within those when I was at home. And you have to change them within different activities, from sitting to standing to laying and what have you.
Mm.
Because whenever you go from sitting to standing, they increase with intensity, the vibration, so you have to change them or else you might get a shock. And so you've got to turn off the machine when you're driving as well, just in case someone hits you when you move and
yes.
The vibration increases. So the pain comes back when you're driving because you've got the machine off. So that was an interesting experience as well, from going from a 2 to a bloody 9
yep.
of pain.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Mm.
It sounds like total science fiction, but it's not, right? You've lived with this for a week.
Yeah, and I'm getting the permanent one,
and
but I just have to wait for about 4 months. I can't wait. I'm going to get a new back and my life back.
Oh, wow.
That's fantastic.
Sounds extraordinary.
Yeah, can't wait. You know, it's so amazing. I can't wait to be at work full time again.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and people dream of not going to work. I can't wait to be back at work again. Full time.
Yeah.
Technology. Thank you.
Technology is good. We, you know, we often look at the negative side of technology because it's something that is just there for us every day and we tend to rely on it and we take it as a given. And then when it doesn't go right, we complain. But this is really one area where it brings such a big, big benefit.
Mm.
And I guess it's not only in sort of pain management. Technology these days has been expanded into lots of different areas. So, you know, I believe there's some technology that dementia patients have been able to take advantage of.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things have been floating around. around recently, and one of is a kind of pillow for dementia sufferers, and it's being used to put on their lap, and it buzzes and vibrates and creates different sensations, and that's proving to be an opportunity for their therapists to have conversations with them, which aren't necessarily about things that they've, you know, done or experienced, and, you know, because of the memory issues, but they can have a real-time conversation about how it feels, and then that process creates interactions, which means that that dementia sufferer can actually sort of have some, you know, interact with someone at a kind of real level sort of thing. So it's sort of one of these sort of technology, medical health things, which is where we kind of started and why we wanted to bring Leanie in to talk. So I think, thank you, Leanie, for, you know, really expanding on your experience there, because like I said, like Michael said, that sort of technology, we often focus on the downsides, but this is an area where it's really revolutionizing.
Oh, you're very welcome. Lives.
Thank you so much.
I can't wait for the permanent one, and if it's a different experience, I'll let you know how it differed.
Yeah. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, lady. So while we're talking about different things around the medical and health area, what's the rise?
The Rise.
Yes.
The Rise is this sensor that you can wear that is designed actually to get you sitting down less and standing up more. So we know from research, etc., that sitting down for a very long time can actually be pretty bad for you. So even if you exercise a lot, or if you're generally pretty healthy or whatever, if you spend a lot of time sitting down, as many of us office workers do, you leave yourself open to a lot of risk to do with cardiac problems, with unhealthy metabolism. And that's actually pretty scary. I mean, we're all sitting down right this instant.
That's right.
And we probably will spend a bit of time sitting down again later today. It's just something that we do.
And I guess the other thing is when you are working and you're concentrating, you tend to lose track of time.
That's right.
Yeah. So you may have the best intentions to say, okay, I'm going to stop and stretch and go for a walk or something like this.
Mm. And well, some weeks back, we talked about things like the Fitbit and the Jawbone, and I've got a Jawbone up. And one of the things that it has done is, because it buzzes once an hour, it reminds me that I've been sitting down and haven't moved.
Mm.
And it's actually prompting me to kind of at least get up and stretch.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if, you know, I mean, this the Rise is, you know, is taking this kind of idea a lot further.
It is. So the Rise can tell. So the Jawbone up, as I understand it, the Jawbone up and the Fitbit can tell if you're not moving at all. So you could be standing, you could be lying down, you could be, you know, floating on a...
It's
on
pretty
a,
limited.
On a banana lounge, whatever.
Oh.
But the... Mm. Yeah, you know, that's a nice kind of relaxation.
In the sun.
That's right. The Rise can tell whether or not you are actually sitting up or standing down. So it uses a little extra sensor stuff going on there. And now it gives you a little buzz if you are sitting too long, but it also records that data, or at least it sends that data to your phone. And the other great thing about the Rise is that the app that comes with it is actually Game Center aware. So if you have an A-word phone, which uses Game Center.
Actually, we're making it sound like an F-word phone, but yes. Have Firefox released those yet? No, sorry.
No. It's anyway, but you can use a center. You can use an app on Game Center that sort of competes with your friends. So if you all have a Rise, you can see which one of you is the most immobile.
So it gamifies your sitting experiences.
It's all about getting off your bum. That's right.
I'm going to get off my bum right now and stand up and lean over into the microphone.
Mm. Now, that's still in a fundraising
stage.
That's
very uncomfortable, though.
Yes.
I'm going to sit down again now.
Yeah, I think you should, Donna.
the device is on Indiegogo getting a fundraising round at the moment. They want 80K and they're expecting to retail it for about 39. So it'll be interesting to see.
It will be good.
Super interesting. Sorry, I got kind of sidetracked there looking at pictures of the Rise. We are just coming up on 12:20. Oh, it's still 12:27 on Joy 94.9. You're talking with Michael, Arena, and Donna, and we'll be back shortly after this.
Technogaze.
Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Technogaze. We're gazing into the world of consumer electronics, gadgets, and technology. I'm here with Michael and Arena, and next we're talking about artificial intelligence.
I don't know if we should be scared about this one or not.
Well, this is one of those kind of sit on the fence things. There's some amazing, amazing kind of uses of this kind of technology, like we just heard from Leanie and technology and health. And there's also some sort of dark side, scary stuff. But I find kind of interesting here is we're getting into Skynet territory now. The Google engineers have been working on artificial intelligence and deep learning have actually got to a point where they don't know what the machines are doing.
I don't think it's they don't know. It's they're finding it very hard to explain how it's coming up with certain
that
things.
That means they don't know.
Okay.
Let's backtrack a little bit.
Well, I can't quite explain it, but something's going on.
Let's sort of backtrack a little bit and talk about what they're actually looking at.
Yes, that's probably wise.
And I think we may have talked about this once or twice upon a time, that they've actually been doing some work with feeding this application some images of cats and things so that it can now identify cats all by itself and a few other bits and pieces. This one now is, it's looking at paper shredders.
What?
Paper shredders.
Paper shredders.
You know, the topic that is on everybody's lips is paper shredders, among other things. And it's sort of, you know, taking in all this data and automatically classifying these paper shredders. It's actually doing a better job of it now than humans. And the engineers really can't explain how it is that it seems to be able to distinguish these different paper shredders.
Yeah, even to the point where I think humans look at the photos of these paper shredders and can't tell some of the subtle differences.
Yes.
And, yeah, and the software can.
It's, well, I don't know. With something like a paper shredder, though, it would very, you know, the form would be well-defined. There's probably a, you know, an image bank that it can, you know, reference. So I don't know if it is that outrageous. Like humans would probably go, well, the details of this particular paper shredder versus that particular paper shredder are actually not that important to me. So why would I retain that information?
You see, we just want to shred paper,
right?
But what if Google's automatic bloody artificial intelligence thinking thing wants to shred its human overlords? I mean, what is going on?
No. Okay, it's not hell, and we don't have any airlocks, so it's, you know.
We don't. I'm sorry, Dave.
You are incompatible with me.
Now, it's a really very specific thing that it does. So, no, there probably isn't going to be a machine uprising anytime soon.
But it's the start where we've got machines and software that are doing things that we really can't explain.
Well, the thing about this is, you know, obviously a paper shredder doesn't seem like a particularly, you know, earth-shattering, you know, use for this kind of thing. But, you know, the thing here is that they're kind of practicing for areas where data-intensive, fields that are very data-intensive, which a human brain can't possibly retain all of that. That's where it will start to become useful.
It's also very rapid things as well. We know that it's work that goes into things like detecting cats and so on. Now, imagine if you could put Google's machine intelligences to work looking at all of the CCTV feeds.
Well, that's
looking
already
for,
happening.
Say, Madeleine McCann. It is already happening, but it's not happening with the great amount of...
Because I don't know if it's true or not, but I have heard that the American law enforcement and security agencies have used Facebook's facial recognition software to track people. Identify
Facebook's
people.
Actual software using, rather than just the images.
Yeah.
Wow.
But even that is not as reliable as it could be. I mean, when I upload pictures, I get all sorts of weird results from that. And I imagine that they would probably do that too. If Google's software can do this faster and better, then what an improvement that is.
I have
also quite evil and scary.
If you do want to like foil facial recognition software, you should put some like Klingon like ridges on your forehead, and that works quite well.
Really?
Sorry.
Kapla.
doesn't Facebook recognise Klingons? Isn't that some form of discrimination?
Apparently it is a way to fool the facial recognition software.
Right. Oh, well.
Interesting.
Yes. Smartwatches.
Oh, again with the smartwatches.
Now, we've spoken about the Galaxy Gear and its amazing rate of return, about 30%.
Apparently.
But Samsung say they've sold 800,000 of them. That's really, really good product.
That's allegedly.
But
don't buy it.
They're talking about the ones they've sold to the shops.
But that's not selling.
Not the ones they've sold to real people.
Apparently,
they haven't
confirmed that that's what they're saying.
Oh, so that's just, you know, hearsay at this point.
But it's consistent with what other people are saying. So there's analysis and whatnot, and it's consistent with other things that Samsung have said. Yeah, we've put this into the channel. Now, what industry sources are reporting is that there's only 50,000 sales, which is not what I'd say is a fantastic approach.
That's not really that many in the scheme of things, is it?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like
and
a
I
lot
wonder,
first, but really?
800,000 to 50,000, that is stuffing your supply chain to the gills.
To the absolute gills. Well, it does sound like, and what a lot of analysts have said, is that they're trying to gazump Apple a little bit by absolutely jamming the channel and expecting that Apple would do a thing. Well, Apple has not yet released a smartwatch. Oh, I said the word.
apple.
He said it in the intro, though. We were already broken.
My fingers were crossed. It didn't count.
My fingers are not crossed.
Where's the zapper?
Oh, sorry. Where's maybe we should ask Leanie if that that device of hers has any sort of punitive application.
Luckily for her, Bluetooth is fairly secure, so we probably can't hack into it.
Now, look, it's probably fair to say, though, that Samsung are trying to get in front of the A word and other retailers by jumping in with their smartwatch, especially in front of Christmas. But
I wonder if any of our listeners have got a smartwatch yet. Are they Pebble, you know, owners? Are they you know, Samsung gear owners?
And one.
Like, tell us, you know one?
I know one Pebble owner as well, probably the same person.
It's Avi, friend of TechnoGaze and Joy in general.
I find like the rise of the telephone, where we started using our phones as a kind of means of personal time telling, a lot of us stopped wearing watches altogether. I wonder if, you know, it's people are going to go back to wearing watches or not. Although my two colleagues here both wearing beautiful analog watches.
Half the time I don't wear it, and it's a lot because I've got the phone and I don't. If I need to see the time, I can look at that. But you know, we're talking about Pebble. Pebble have got a new app that's available.
Yes,
it's a banking app.
Yes, and you don't need a Galaxy tablet in order to use your Pebble Watch, so maybe this is the sort of model that will work really well. Tell us about this app.
Well, the app will tell you what your current balance is, and it will allow you to review transactions, and will even give you vibration alerts when you reach your overdraft. Which sounds fine, but to be honest, my banking isn't so much of a priority that I need to check my transactions every 5 seconds.
I personally would like to find out before I hit my overdraft, if that's all right, okay.
Well, that's why it vibrates as you're hitting your overdraft.
As you're hitting it. No, sorry. Well before.
You probably can set it.
Like, Telstra have started bugging me about my data limits. So maybe, you know, we get, hey, your bank account is now at 15% off and falling. Something like that.
Well, 15%
you are now insolvent. Please go to your nearest somewhere or other.
Please go hock all your things and put money in your account.
Yes. So that should be out soon. And in fact, the manufacturer or the software developers looking for banks to take it on, so we might see that in reality.
I think if nothing else, it's useful just to sort of you know, another way to keep track of your spending, or you know, notice if somebody's buying a giant plasma with your credit card. Or
and it's interesting that they chose to do this for the Pebble and not for the Galaxy Gear.
I can't imagine why.
No.
But the Pebble is programmable, right? I mean, that's one of the things about the Pebble is anyone can get in there and start creating apps for it, because it's got an open SDK and all of that kind of stuff.
Theoretically, anyone could, if they really wanted to, develop things for Samsung devices, but
who wants to?
Yes.
Sorry.
So, Google, the do-no-evil company, has done evil.
Oh, what?
Mm.
So they've been caught out ignoring the user privacy settings in Safari. So most browsers now have an ability to say, do not track me, or, you know, hide my identity from the websites that I'm visiting. And Google have just been going,
never mind,
oops.
I remember hearing this about 18 months to 2 years ago, and they were bragging about it because they had found a flaw in Safari and they had found a way to get around it.
Oh. So they paid up $17 million.
Yes.
You know, let's be real. Google has how much?
Oh, oodles.
Yeah. So $17 million to them is like...
like a paper cut?
I don't think that would even make a dent on their smartwatch banking app, to be honest.
I think it's a case of, yeah, we can do this, we'll probably get caught, but we'll deal with it and we'll pay for it when we get caught, and it's going to be nothing compared to the benefit.
Exactly. Is it an acceptable amount to pay?
This is the second time they were fined. They were fined previously $22.5 million from the Federal Trade Commission over the same thing. But, you know, you'd think the company that prides itself on saying we do no evil wouldn't even go near anything like that, because, you know, you're disrespecting user wishes.
Yeah, but even Google is all about tracking user data, full stop. That is their business model. And if you've got some kind of mechanism which stops you having their data and they're going to get around it, well, that's the business reality for them. The fact that, you know, they kind of try and make it safe by saying it's all aggregated, it doesn't really identify you individually, blah-de-blah-de-blah.
That's hardly the point. I don't want to participate and I shouldn't be participating. I don't care if it's aggregate or anything else.
Yeah, and if the tool allows me to make settings like that, then I expect them to respect those settings, especially because they take the time out to say we do no evil.
And so are we all going to be stopping using our Google
search engine, we will think about Gmail, them slightly differently, and we may not be as welcoming to them as we were before.
Let's hope so.
Mm.
Yes. So, talking about Google.
Mm. Yes.
They're going to pay us money for a change.
Oh, what?
Yes. If you can successfully hack into Android and some of their other open source products, they will reward you by paying you anywhere from between $500 and $3,133.70. I'd love to know where they came up with that figure from.
It is a very odd number,
isn't
it?
Does it translate to something interesting in hex? Maybe a rude word? I don't know.
Is it?
Leet.
It's leet.
Is it?
Oh, 31337. Leet.
Elite.
My mistake.
Isn't that good?
Super cute.
Okay.
Apparently one of them, one notable hacker identity named Pinkie Pie has already cashed in.
Nice.
Finding a couple of
Pinkie
vulnerabilities.
Pinkie Pie?
Pinkie Pie.
I was watching Hackers last night, actually. Remember that movie?
Really? Because I was
90s.
Watching My Little Pony.
Really?
Pinkie Pie.
Nice.
Now, I dare say, you know, they're paying out this money, but I'm sure it is far, far less than their engineers working through the code to track and to fix these problems.
Indeed. But if you can find it, if you're just sort of mucking around and stuff anyway, then why not? Especially if you can get elite dollars.
Elite dollars. Gee. Yes, so crowdsourcing is good.
Apparently.
Yes. Now, our last story, or our next story. ANU, the Australian National University, have made a breakthrough with lasers that could make computers in the future much faster,
frickin' lasers.
Frickin' lasers.
So lasers these days, you know, work really well, and to use a laser to transfer data is much faster than using normal wires because electrons travel far, far slower than light. But the problem with lasers is that you need expensive equipment, you need to have mirrors and all sorts of things, which makes it prohibitive for putting into computers.
Right.
But what the ANU have done is they've come up with some nanowire technology, and these nanowires are several billionths of a metre in diameter, so really, really small. And this can be used to send laser light or send light through it. And unlike other nanowire technology that's around, this can operate at room temperature.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So they're thinking that practical application of this will be about 15 years' time.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So 15 years' time. So I guess when maybe do you think that would be for the desktop, or is that more for...
I think it would be anywhere.
Special supercomputers?
No, I think it would be desktop, mobile devices, the whole works.
Good old ANU.
Yeah.
Who says nothing good ever comes from Canberra?
Exactly. It's 18 minutes to 1. This is TechnoGaze on Joy 94.9. TechnoGaze. This is TechnoGaze on Joy 94.9. It's 16 minutes to 1. And in the studio today, we've got Raina, Donna, and myself, Michael. And we're also very lucky to have, as our guest, Marigo Raftopoulos. Hi.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
And it would help if I turned on your microphone.
Oh, so I'd have to say hello all over again.
You can say hello all over again.
Hey, everyone.
I was wondering why I couldn't hear you. So, Marigo's here because she's a world-leading expert on gamification.
God, I hate that term.
I know you do. That's why I use it.
What is gamification, and should we use another word?
We should use another word, but the horse has bolted already.
Too late. Bye-bye.
But it's all gone. It's a word that gamers hate completely,
mm-hmm.
And the business community just doesn't get. You know, games, work, you know, we're here to do serious business, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it's a term that's stuck at the moment, so we're using it. So, and it best describes what we're trying to do. It's using game thinking or games to use within business contexts, health, education, the works, to raise awareness, increase motivation,
so
engagement.
Use
kind of
games as in play them, or use games in what way?
Right, in probably three different ways, actually. First of all is to actually use a game. So either you build a specific game or you use an off-the-shelf type game to actually explore different concepts and ideas. And a lot of that revolves around, you know, how we work together, how we better engage with each other, how to touch upon those creative skills that's inside us, and how do we bring that out into the workplace or into the health and education activities that we've got at stake. The other part is to actually look at the actual philosophy and the concepts and the frameworks behind how games are actually designed. Because if you look at a game designer, their first and foremost priority is to engage people in an activity. Whereas if you look at anything in any other part of our systems, in business, education in particular, it's all about efficiency and throughput. So, you know, people come, not last, but the first priority is, you know, maximise throughput, return on investment, and we're just sort of cogs in that machine. But a game designer puts human spirit and motivation right up front. So what is it that motivates us, and how do we engage in our material in a completely different way?
Would it be fair to say that a big thing that probably motivates a lot of people is being competitive, basically, trying to beat somebody at doing a thing, get more badges, collect more trophies?
That's the thing. That's the most common perception of what motivates people to play games. And it's not always the case, you know. There's obviously the winning, the racing type games. But some of the more popular games, in terms of entertainment games, are the God games or the building games. So you're building communities like Sims and all
Minecraft.
Those. Absolutely. So that's all about creativity, creating empires and looking at and solving puzzles is another big genre as well.
Is it also about community and belonging?
Yeah. Usually the building games are very much about sort of creating those communities, because most games are multiplayer in some form or other. Even if it's not online multiplayer, you're playing with other people who, you know, you're sort of sharing that. And even competitive games are community-based games too, because to be competitive means that you want to stand out amongst your peers and community. So it's the social aspect is a very important part of all games.
What about the element that a lot of games actually give you a safe space to fail, to trial and error in a way that is not going to be dangerous? Is that an element in this?
Totally. In fact, that's how serious games started. It started post-war when the military adopted game thinking and used to create war simulations and things like that. So, in fact, all the major game engines that we're using today in terms of the war shoot 'em up sort of type games have risen out of all the heavy investment that the military put into games.
That's kind of scary in a way too.
It is kind of scary, but someone's got to make the initial investment, and we learn from that as well.
Well, we got the internet that way as well. So.
That's right, absolutely.
So how's Australia placed in this compared to the rest of the world? Are we ahead?
In terms of gamification, I think we're a little bit slower on the adoption scale. I mean, I've done sort of work in US, Europe, and now Asia's emerging as a huge growth market as well. So I think initially we sort of perked up, thought, oh, this is interesting, we could do something in this, but I think Australian communities, particularly the business communities, tend to hold back a little bit. So we're waiting to see what everyone else does. So any initial gains we made, we're sort of falling a bit behind now. I think US and Europe, very strong, and I think Asia is surpassing us now.
So one of the areas that you've been working with is in relation to Asia and the AVARS organisation. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So with Internews. So it's a game that we're starting to scope at the moment, because we're looking at gay, lesbian, bi and transgender issues within Asia. Now, usually with, you know, Asia is a little bit more relaxed in those issues as well. So what they're doing now, we're developing, concepting some games that will be used in the business community, mainly in China at the moment. We've sort of got sort of eight organisations that are looking to implement these games in the workforce to look at how to raise awareness for diversity, for inclusion, and using it like that. There is obviously a sell in that entails greater teamwork, greater collaboration, hence creativity and innovation as well when you have greater diversity in the workforce. So that's an issue that's really taken a lot of energy within Asia at the moment, because within the entertainment games community, they've been a lot more sort of inclusive in that space than what they have in the West.
Are there any applications that are better or more suited to gamification than others from a business sense?
It's at the moment, if there's a human involved, all applications are open to being gamified in some way to improve engagement.
Because I could imagine training is a huge candidate.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Can you give us perhaps a practical example of how gamification works in something like that, either training or some other scenario?
Yeah, training and development. And that's working with not only children, like millennials, but also young adults as well. And now we're developing some games that we're using for like older, more professional profiles, you know, looking at 35+, which is sort of outside of the typical gaming genre. There's I won't name the company, a major consulting firm that's used it. In fact, a few of them have. One is using it for onboarding, understanding what the whole broad complex range of tasks in this organisation involves. Other one is for a leadership development program. I think Deloitte has been very open about that one as well. well. So all the up-and-coming leaders within your organisation, using games to actually engage them with learning more, learning better, learning faster, and learning in a bit more sort of a creative way, because we all have completely different learning styles, and games helps us explore all those various options rather than sort of very sort of straightforward linear programs that has been typical in the past.
I guess I'm kind of struggling to think about how maybe a less exciting application could have that applied to them. So if I'm thinking about our HR system where we apply for leave, for example,
leave, right. Yes.
I can't imagine, you know, competing with anyone or any badges or any sort of narrative around that.
Yeah. Well, they've, one of the supposedly most boring jobs in the world was Target cashiers, right? What can you do to? And there's a high turnover amongst those staff there, and a lot of mistakes being made, and all this kind of stuff. So Target said, "Okay, why don't we gamify this to see if we can sort of lift their game a little bit?" So they developed a game where the cashier had to estimate where the shopper put. Plonked their shopping on the bench,
yep.
And the cashier had to estimate how long it would take them to process this batch of shopping. So they would estimate, you know, like 3 minutes. And then the race was on. That would see how fast they can actually process the shopping cart, and then to see how do they win, do they lose, do they gain points, etc. Motivation skyrocketed. Throughput and efficiency just sort went through the roof, because these kids were engaged in something that was ordinarily mind-numbing, but now it was some entertainment value. It was a competition against self as well. They did have leaderboards in terms of how they were competing with the other cashiers. So any job, big or small, is open. Anything that involves a human that requires any form of improvement or change, or particularly for creativity and innovation, is open.
Is there an interconnection between what's been going on in the gamification world and, say, the neuroscience stuff about how our brains work? Has there kind of been like crossover there in the learnings?
Yeah, there has. I mean, with the wonderful thing about game design over the last, say, sort of 30, 40 years is that it's evolved as a craft. Now that we're sort of doing, we've been doing globally game studies for the last several decades, and you can see the convergence of what we understand in neuroscience, in behavioural sciences, and all those kinds of things. It shows us what game designers have been doing all along as an art.
So it's confirming what we've been learning.
Absolutely.
Along the way.
Yeah, so we're sort of reverse engineering the science of games and finding those immense, you know, neurological drivers, you know, the dopamine hits, the, you know, all the what happens in a hormonal level when we compete, when we create. We can actually document why games have been so popular in the past and how they're now becoming so much more popular, because our workforces are disengaged. Like, you've seen that studies that on average only 20% of your workforce is actively engaged on the job, 40% are enrolled but not committed, and the last 40% is actively disengaged.
Oh, wow.
I hate my job.
Yeah.
So what we can learn from games is that how can we reverse that? Stop thinking of people as machines and start thinking of them as people that want to be engaged, they want to be productive and creative. So how can we get the best out of our people?
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's a great field, and it's something that I could imagine is just going to permeate through organisations into the future. Well, hopefully it will.
Absolutely. Like I've been around a long time, and I've seen fads come and go. This one is really inspired people from all ages, and particularly decision makers in government, in high levels of business. So once you get the, I'm not saying they're the most important people, but they control the investment within schools, within hospitals, within our businesses, that are really crippling at the moment in terms of their performance and all that kind of thing. So if they're looking for different ways to engage people, to improve how our systems are operating, then we're well on our way to at least seeing some sort of meaningful or sustainable change.
Thank you so much, Mariga, for coming in and talking to us about it.
My pleasure.
I think it's a really fascinating area, and that really extending what humans can do with technology in ways that make their lives more fun in the real world as well, instead of just, you know, in their game world. So
totally.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
It's 5 minutes to one. So we are really right on the end of our magic hour here at Technogaze. But we have a little bit more to talk about just after this.
Technogaze. Joy 94.9.
It's 3 minutes to one here on Technogaze, and we're just about done for the day. It's been a pleasure like usual.
It's always just a little bit too much fun.
A little bit.
Just a little bit.
I might need a cup of tea after this to settle down.
Now, just and an iced Vovo?
Maybe a nice Bicky. The last little thing we were going to talk about, it is, of course, coming up to the Christmas season, and if you are in need of a present, then you could probably do better than this. Microsoft are selling some anti-Google merchandise talking about not getting scroogled.
I find this totally, totally bizarre and totally, hey, pot, calling kettle black.
There's all these great things like keep calm while we steal your data, etc. Well, never mind how much stuff they take away from
on
us.
On a mug or on a cap or on a T-shirt.
Oh, they've been playing around with the word cloud making things.
But they've also got these little videos where they talk about how terrible Google is and how it's like sending all of your data. It's reading all of your emails and reading all of your data. And it's kind of like, yes, yes, Google is. And yes, it's very bad. But Microsoft has been doing the exact same thing. So I really don't understand how they're trying to take the moral high ground on this.
Well, I just don't know why they think that anyone would actually buy that and wear it around.
Oh, well, but we'll put the link up on our Facebook page and maybe tweet it.
Have
and
a good laugh
people
at
can
it.
Have a look at it.
You know, check out the videos. They're pretty cheesy.
Yeah. Well, that's all we have for today. If you've missed any part of the show or perhaps you're looking to peruse previous episodes, you can go to the Joy website, joy.org.au/technogaze. Coming up next is a news bulletin with Matt Thompson, followed by Cravings with Pete Dillon. Raina, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
And Donna, thank you as well.
Thank you, Michael.
Have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll catch you next week when we help celebrate Joy's 20th birthday. And we're sure to have loads of fun.
Cannot
wait.
See
you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Technogaze on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.